This is Monocle on Design, a show where we discuss everything from architecture and craft to furniture and fashion. I'm Nick Manise. On today's program, we're looking to design museums, the buildings, objects and practices involved, and we're imagining what these spaces could be. All that coming up on Monocle on Design. Hello and welcome to today's show. I'm joined by Monocle's associate editor and the producer of Monocle on Culture on Monocle Radio, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Sophie, I guess we're here to kind of set up the program. You edit and produce a program that is, I mean, museums are in it. Is that fair to say?
I can confirm. Lots of museum visits, lots of exhibition openings.
With this in mind, we figured you were sort of the in-house expert on this topic. To start, I mean, tell us what, in your mind, and there's no right or wrong answer here, we're looking for the Monocle House definition, but what is a design museum specifically? How does that differ perhaps from a museum that might be hosting other disciplines?
Well, it's so interesting because design just feeds into everything. It's the same as culture. Everything can have a cultural slant to it. You can look at the design of anything. And for me, at least, I think a design museum is just about bringing that to the fore. And it's making people appreciate that aspect of something. One example is an exhibition that we actually covered on Monocle on Culture, which was London Design Museum exhibition on football. It was also about the culture of football and football fans and football stadiums and all of these things that are tangential but associated with the sport. And it was really about the design of it. So it's just about highlighting that. And I think the nice thing about design museums is that they can bring in a new crowd to something which people already think they have an understanding of, or they've never thought of it in a particular way and appreciated that aspect of it.
You're spot on. Everything kind of has a design thread running through it. Ultimately, there's very little that's brought into our world without some sort of design. You know, sometimes I guess I wish we all wish maybe a little bit more thought was given to the design of things. The Design Museum in London is that perfect example. You mentioned football there. I was going to bring up saris, which has featured previously on this show. Fashion, sure, but there's also textile and manufacturing that goes into that. I'm going to ask the very dumb questions here. What's the benefit of focusing on design as a specific discipline in terms of curation? What's the hope, I guess, for these museums? Is it to encourage people to maybe look at the design that surrounds us?
I think it's about bringing a kind of different appreciation to things and an understanding that everything has been designed, everything has been thought through. And I think the design, you know, museums, having them separately is a way of both taking saris or football or whatever it might be to a new audience and kind of getting people that wouldn't necessarily go to a football exhibition to appreciate something different about it. But on top of that, it's about getting new audiences into museums and people that wouldn't necessarily go to an exhibition at the V&A or something, they might go to the design museum and feel a little bit more like they fit in there. So I think it's about expanding that world in two ways, really.
You mentioned the V&A, maybe perhaps that sounds intimidating as an organisation versus the design museum, which certainly sounds like they're two words I understand. I have no idea who Victoria and Albert are, but I know what a design museum is. I mean, how important are these spaces to cities, to people, to, I guess, starting to build these dialogues?
These spaces are so important. Obviously, I would say that. But I think depending on where you are in the world and which kind of museums or spaces you visit, you can tell when they're being done right and when they feel open and accessible and they feel like there's something there for experts who already have a kind of grounding in whatever the discipline is. But there's also lots there for children and there's a real kind of entryway into learning about art and design or whatever it might be. That's so obvious compared to places that feel very closed up and intimidating and not like they're welcome to people and they're really expensive and there's always the same clientele going to see these different exhibitions. Some of these museum prices, they're also limited edition runs, they sell out, they're, you have to go midweek, you have to spend a lot of money on it. It's for a certain type of person, and I think that's a real shame. And there are lots of places, especially elsewhere in Europe, that are doing that in a much better way, and they're making sure that people from all walks of life and from all ages are coming. And in the long term, that's way more beneficial because you have people who are invested in those institutions who are going to give money back into them when they've made it compared to the people at the moment who are championing them who aren't going to be around forever.
Over the course of the next 25 minutes or so, we're going to sort of look at cities that do have design museums, that don't have design museums. You started to allude to it there, I guess, the ingredients that are essential for a good museum. Let's sort of design our own one right now. I mean, what are some of the key things? It sounds like good branding, accessible pricing. Are there any other sort of facets that you think are essential to building this fantasy design museum, as it were?
Programming that responds to where it is really important. I love programming that's really imaginative, and if it's an art museum that brings in the kind of old masters and the classics, but it puts them alongside new and emerging artists, especially from the local area, something that puts a different angle on the kind of classic art museum exhibition. You know, you'll always have people that are willing to go to the new Picasso Museum. How do you bring in a new audience to that, and how do you do it in a slightly different, innovative way? It has to have a beautiful space. It has to be accessible in lots of different ways. Also, it's great when there's a really lovely cafe and there's a really nice shop. And I think those things are important and they bring in more people and add an extra income stream for the institution. And that's always helpful.
For me, it sounds like really grounding it in place with local designers alongside, I guess, the work of big name designers or big name artists. Sounds incredible. Let's also sell some of their wares in the gift shop. We've talked a little bit about the Design Museum here in London. Who else is doing it well across the world? Who else can we look to, you know, on that benchmarking slide for our dream design museum? Who else is appearing alongside the London Design Museum and John Pawson's architecture there?
I want to go very local with this question and talk about an organisation doing it very well on a very small scale, and that's the Migration Museum in London. It is very local to me. It's in a shopping centre. It's free. It's got a constantly changing programme, which is always exploring just the kind of impact of migration on London, but they do it in really fun ways. You can go in, they'll transform part of it into a barber shop. You sit down in the barber's chair and you can put headphones on and hear stories about migration, or you can walk into a mock-up newsagent's and pick up different food items, kind of fake food items, and read little stories on them about migration. It's free, it's accessible, it's really kid-friendly, it's got a great shop, and it's really small. The people who are doing it really, really well.
Benchmarks are essential for initiating any sort of projects. I'm glad we've kind of got those teed up. Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm joined by this show's producer, Mae Lee Evans. You've been to Japan House recently. Tell us a little bit about the exhibition you saw and how that relates to the theme of today's show.
Their current exhibition, Design Discoveries Towards a Design Museum Japan, is currently on show. What I found really interesting about this and immediately piqued my interest was, you know, as a country, we think about its design, its heritage, the craftsmanship that's survived many thousands of years. But there's actually no dedicated National Museum of Design, which kind of seemed bonkers to me. And so this exhibition has brought together a group of leading Japanese designers, and they're from all different disciplines, including fashion, architecture. There's also a video game designer, so they've been quite loose and flex with their definition of a designer. So we've got a filmmaker in the mix as well. And they've just asked, if there were a permanent Japanese design collection, what would you put in there?
Tell us a little bit about what's on the proverbial plinth, I guess, at Japan House.
We've got everything from wooden spinning toys to earthenware. But then you've also got this spoon that is readily available in most shops that I guess a lot of people probably have in their cupboard and haven't looked twice at. And right from these paper templates through to its final forms.
I know NHK, Japan's public media broadcaster, were also involved. Tell us the role that they played in this showcase.
NHK put together these series of programmes, and this was documenting that research process that those designers took, so visiting smaller museums that were involved in bringing these pieces together. Again, to allow visitors to see these pieces in context, it's once you see the town that it was produced, you start to understand, okay, this is why we've used this wood, or this is why we're focusing on these techniques. So it helps ground it and make it feel a little bit less isolated.
Amazing. And you spoke to senior producer at NHK at Japan House, Kuramori Kyoko. Let's hear from them now.
A lot of people think of Japan as a design nation, but in fact, there is no National Design Museum. So many people have mentioned that wouldn't it be better to have a design museum in Japan over the last century or so? And one of the most passionate advocate was Issey Miyake. Issei Miyake have started advocating this idea of creating a design museum in Japan around 1979, and he was very consistent and passionate about this idea. And I got to know him when I was making arts program and got to work with him very closely. And around 2012, his idea, he really started to work towards creating this idea and making it a reality to create a national design museum. Miyake had a strong idea that a design museum needs to have a collection, a wide-ranging collection. But creating a design museum is no simple task. There needs to be a whole process to design the design museum itself, because we need to think about the contents and the purpose of the museum, as well as what goes into the collection, as well as how they are being displayed as well. The process really began from that ground zero. Then that poses a question: what is a design? And most people would think of design as luxurious items, perhaps high-end labels, top-end cars. But everything that exists in the world are either natural items or man-made items. Man-made items, any of them, could be regarded as there was some kind of design process involved with that. It would be impossible to collect everything that was designed in this world. That's why we thought of this idea of possibly let's focus on the smaller existing museums that already has collections, either contemporary or historic, and perhaps we could form a network of those collections that already exist all across Japan. There is a risk of focusing on those smaller local museums, because a lot of the people would consider those museums and its collection as boring, perhaps, because they're so used to seeing them. That's why we have recruited very well-known, flourishing creatives who are considered experts in those fields to go on to these research trips of these treasure hunting of design treasures, to really look into their creative process, but also how they are relevant to the contemporary lives that we live in, because I believe that design needs to be relevant to the everyday lives that we are living. What we are exhibiting here is no different to what we have exhibited in other locations that we have gone on the tour. But I believe that the perception of the exhibition might be slightly different. For example, in Japan, when we held this, most people would see the exhibition as the exhibition of everyday objects, something that they are used to, familiar with. However, when we went to LA, Sao Paulo, and possibly in London as well, people would probably view it as something that is slightly exotic, something that might be not be part of what they are used to. But our intent is that we would like the locals here, Londoners, to be inspired to look into design in their everyday objects as well after this exhibition. So really go beyond that boundary of something that they are not familiar with. So just to explain the context, we are regarding the concept of design in a very wide-ranging area in this exhibition. We don't just mean the types of objects, but we mean the historical eras as well. We are including the contemporary design, modern design, and also prehistoric items as well is part of this exhibition from more than 10,000 years ago. Yes, we are confident in what we are exhibiting, but there has been a questioning part in my brain as well, whether we are going in the right direction or not. I have had some talks and interviews with my contemporaries in the UK and other countries as well. Those experiences have led to more confidence in me, really. Yes, the selection of the items have been the right ones, but also this idea of building a network amongst smaller museums, local museums, to create a very wide-ranging collection. people have mentioned, yes, that's a great idea. That's a model that we could use in other countries as well, perhaps, that do not have a design museum. Perhaps they could look into recreating that model as well through this touring exhibition.
So that was Kuromori Kiyoko there. Nick, out of interest, what would you put into a design museum? I was thinking if there was an Aussie version and you had free reign, what would you put in there?
I love this. I'm right here for it. I already know who I'm going to get to curate it. It's Tim Ross. He's an amazing Australian broadcaster, former comedian, now design historian and mid-century expert. And he has previously curated some amazing exhibitions on Australian design, curated one rather at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney a few years ago. And actually seeing that exhibition myself really inspired me to buy some pieces of Australian design. I think what Tim really specialised in is looking at the everyday objects that surround us that are amazing. One of them is the dolphin torch. I actually went out and purchased this after seeing it at the design exhibition at the Powerhouse Museum. It's the Mark II dolphin torch, which was designed in Sydney by Paul Coburn in 1974. It became the highest selling torch in the world. And what I loved about it is the fact that it's kind of boxy in its shape, so you can lay it on any of the sides. You can stand it on its end. It can work as a lantern. It can work as a directional torch. It's just this really wonderful piece of design. It's quite sturdy because it's made for camping and fishing. You'd find them rolling around in the backs of people's cars. A really sturdy, everyday piece of design. And I actually, went out and purchased one and used it as a lamp in my house because you really can angle it and position it everywhere, and it's just an outstanding piece of design.
So that's what you would put in your very own Aussie design museum.
Yes, I think that's the starting point. But let's not drift too far away from that subject. I guess you asked me that question off the back of Design Discoveries Towards a Design Museum Japan. That's on show at Japan House until the 8th of September 2024. A quick pit stop to Finland now, where, back in April, Helsinki launched an international competition to design the city's new flagship architecture and design museum. To be placed in a prominent position in the city's South Harbour, the new museum will showcase Finland's rich heritage in design and architecture. The space will also seek to engage visitors to reflect on the role of design, and it hopes to democratise the tools of design. Monocle's Helsinki correspondent, Petri Bertsov, met Kaarna Gold, the CEO of the foundation in charge of the upcoming museum. She began by explaining why the city needs this institution.
Well, if you think about Finland's legacy in design and architecture, it's kind of obvious that you would think that this would be the place where you would have an outstanding institution for architecture and design. And yet our two museums are operating in buildings that were never meant to be museums. And when we look forward 10, 20, 30, 50 years, it's obvious that museum practices are changing. The expectations from museum visitors are changing. So we're super excited now that we're in a phase where we can say that in the next 6 to 7 years, we will have a new museum building that will make the museum relevant for decades to come.
You've recently launched a high-profile international design competition for the museum. Tell us more about the museum's location in Helsinki and why it's important that the museum features great architecture.
Well, the location for the new museum is on a historically significant site in Helsinki. It's in the South Harbour area on a district which will be now newly developed by the city of Helsinki. It's right next to the city hall, right next to the Alvar Aalto's famous sugar cube building in the vicinity of a UNESCO heritage site, the Suomenlinna Sea Fortress. So there's really a lot of cultural and historical value in the site. And it's right in the center of Helsinki, so it will really be a new landmark for Helsinki. And it's really exciting now that architects around the world can take part in this competition and really think about what the home of architecture and design will look like on this beautiful waterfront site.
You know, when we talk about a museum of design and architecture, it's obviously we're talking about a very broad remit. Can you talk a bit more about what the focus will be?
Well, naturally, we will present the narrative of Finnish architecture and design. There will be a core core exhibition, a dynamic exhibition about the history and the present and the future of architecture and design in Finland and in the Nordics. And if you look at the Nordics, design and architecture have really played a role in building our welfare democracies, our Nordic democracies. So that's a great legacy to lean on when we think about the focus and the profile of the museum. So we're really thinking about it from the perspective of sharing the tools of design, sharing the tools of curiosity for the visitors of the museum to have a better understanding how those tools can be used for building better, sustainable, more sustainable societies and environments.
Now, of course, Finland as a country has a very rich heritage, as you previously alluded to, in both design and architecture. Names like Alvar Aalto, Eero Saarinen, Eliasaarinen, Artek Iittala, they're globally recognized household names in those fields. And these are just a few examples out of many. But often also in Finland, these big names, these star architects, they somehow somewhat overshadow younger and emerging names in both of these fields. Will the museum also aim to broaden the public's understanding of Finnish design and architecture instead of just focusing on the few great names?
I think in general the museum will celebrate design and architecture on a global scale. So we will naturally present Finnish architecture and design, but the profile of the museum is international. But I think this new flagship museum will be a great chance also to make Finnish architecture and design, contemporary architecture and design, and all the interesting immaterial design solutions that we're developing also more known to the world.
Finally, I also wanted to sort of hear your thoughts on the whole concept of what makes a museum these days, because I suppose this like old-fashioned thinking of what a museum is, a place where the visitor feels more like a passive sort of passerby who's just observing things that other people have defined noteworthy for them, while then a perhaps more contemporary understanding of a museum would be a place of reflection, dialogue, even for communities of coming together. The new museum, how have you taken into account this changing nature of what a museum is?
I think we've been really thinking about it holistically, and we really hope that this new museum will somehow redefine the definition of a museum. Helsinki recently opened a new central library, Oodi, and that has really changed the way we think about libraries, so we're hoping to have a similar kind of impact with this museum. Naturally, the core task of the museum is harnessing cultural heritage and with the merger of the Design Museum of Helsinki and the Finnish Museum of Architecture, we have nearly a million artifact collection to showcase Finnish architecture and design and the heritage of that. But what we really aim to do is to use that as a tool of opening windows to the world through those collections, through design and architecture. So I'm really thinking of the museum more as a, not as a museum of design and architecture, but a museum of the world where we're looking at the world through the window of architecture and design.
My thanks to Petri Bertsoff there in conversation with Kaarna Gold. Entries for stage one submissions for the competition ends on the 29th of August 2024. So if you're an architect anywhere across the globe, do consider, sending in some drawings and some concepts. Speaking of seeing work, Maile, you go to a host of different museums and exhibitions. We've already heard Japan House. Do you have a favourite dedicated design and creative museum that you can reference, perhaps for somebody looking for a benchmark for a submission for this Helsinki project?
Well, last year I visited the V&A Dundee. So this is Scotland's design museum and it's right on the harbour. I think there's something about harbourside spots that they're inspiring. You've got that horizon line. It opens your brain up to new ideas and blue sky thinking. Why not? It's by Kengo Kuma, completed in 2018, but there was just a way it really spoke to the environment around it and genuinely does feel like an exciting place to visit. I think as much as we talk about museums being a place to learn about design, the fact is for some people it's entertainment, it's a day out with also a bit of maybe education added as well. And I think when you have a building that looks incredible, you want to get up close, you want to take a photo with it. And that might be the genesis for someone to step inside. this really cool building. Never seen anything like it. Right, what's going on inside? And I think there's something about how a building's structured, how open it is to the public, the way it sits within its environment, that can be a draw for people, or it might turn them away. What about you, Nick? Any buildings that have really got you excited?
If we're going to be talking about a design museum, you'd hope it would be in a museum that is well designed. I mean, I'm always going to go for something that's, you know, if we're talking about entries, something that looks to invite people in. I tend to be turned away by quite institutional looking structures. I want something that seems quite civic and quite playful in terms of an entry. That is always sort of the starting point. That said, I think the V&A Museum in London can do that quite well. It's this quite old institutional style building, but they've reconfigured a courtyard with some contemporary installations. There's a pavilion cafe in the entryway, which automatically is a signal to come in because it's an invitation for commerce, or to come in and grab a shot of espresso. Once you're in there, it sort of pulls you into the building itself. So I think there is something to be said about the entry point for the museum. And then once you're inside, you certainly would hope that the exhibition space has been set up to be logical, to flow, that you can get a read on how quickly or gently and slowly you should move through the actual space itself. So maybe, you know, your experience at the V&A in Dundee, mine at the one in London, perhaps we combine them. We put in a submission ourselves for this Helsinki competition. How does that sound?
I'll get the drawing board ready.
On the show so far, we've been looking at imagined spaces and, I guess, proposals for whole new buildings. But what about those structures that already exist? Maile Evans, tell us where we're headed next.
I was recently in Zurich and went to their design museum, the Museum für Gestaltung, where the team there are revisiting their own collections and the processes involved, including curation, research and education. Their current exhibition, Collection Insights, Seven Perspectives, welcomes a range of collaborators to look at what is already there, some of the objects, but also how it might be presented to the public and the way that these items are used and shared. What's different to the Japan House exhibition is these aren't leading creators top of their field. In this instance, we've got young people involved. We've got emerging curators. So these are very different perspectives than having those headline names that you might see front and centre winning awards. And so I think there's something interesting that happens when you are drawing from people with very different life experiences who have a very different take on the world.
It's a re-examining of how we might present and talk about design, which really is what today's episode has been about. So you caught up with one of the museum's curators, Damien Fopp. Let's hear from him now.
We are now standing in the climate-controlled basement of our museum here. We have our collections on display. Two spaces in front of us. On the right-hand side, we have a collection highlights. This has been an exhibition that's been running for the past five years. It shows the best of what we've got in our collection, selected by our collection curators, so total experts on their fields with a huge knowledge. This is the traditional way how collections have been displayed in museums all over the world. And we think this still has an absolute value. It's fantastic to see these very wonderful objects on display. But we also think we wanted to add a newer take on how to display collections. We wanted to open up our collections to a wider audience, to different perspectives. And so we added a new wing here on the left side, which is called Collection Insights. We feel as a public institution and also a government-funded institution, we have a responsibility to not only be a house for a certain elite, an elite that appreciates good design or good aesthetics. And we want to be a fairly democratic institution that allows for many different conversations to take place and many different perspectives to claim our space as well. And that's like one of the reasons why we open up our collections, which are usually rather closed off, and we try to get different perspectives on our collection and what's in it and why it is in it and why it is interesting. This is a contribution where we invited future curators. These are students from the curatorial studies department of the ZHDK, the Zurich University of the Arts. So they're not quite experts yet, but will be the future. We allowed them to come and select different posters from our vast poster collection. Very playful installation. We have these tiny little holes in the wall where you can look through and see posters that somehow either have like eyes on them, that have a gaze, that maybe have a face that looks back at you. They thought it was really important that we think about how do we look at posters, how do posters look back at us. We have some advertising posters of the police here in Switzerland. They managed to kind of put like really interesting pairings. Sometimes the police officer is like looking at other people, and if you look through the hole, you're not quite sure. Is he checking other posters inside this installation? So they really managed to create a kind of a conversation just with posters, and I think that's what curating is really about, to tell stories with the objects in our collection.
Walk me through this. This I found really interesting. It's kind of the idea of taking historical objects and then bringing it into sort of the digital computer-aided design realm.
Our collections are actively being used by a lot of people for academic projects, publications and so on, where people come and ask to see our collections. But we also use them, for example, in education. The industrial designers of the Zurich University of the Arts, they have been using various objects from our collection actually when learning to draw objects digitally, to construct them virtually, as it is this tool that today designers, well, of course, they mostly work digitally, they reconstruct or they design their objects in a three-dimensional environment. And instead of just learning these tools with fictitious objects, the students now head into our collections and they will pick certain objects from our collection and they will try to reconstruct these as closely as possible. And during this time, of course, they learned the tools, the digital tools that are needed to reconstruct our collection object, but also they have a very intricate exchange with these masterpieces that we have in our collections. They learn so much about different materials, different curves, different shapes, how are objects put together, what are the proportions of certain objects, because if you have to reconstruct something, you really have to zoom in into each object, follow it very closely. And I think for us, it's a fantastic opportunity to really bring life into our collection and open it up and make it accessible and give it a purpose today instead of just having the objects stowed away and dusting them off every now and then. In the back there's a hairdryer. It's a design from the 80s. It has this very intricate hole pattern on it where the air would go in, a sort of a vent with this circular array of holes. It's fairly, fairly difficult to create a beautiful pattern of holes like the one on here. Of course, today digital tools allow you to very quickly draw up one of these patterns, but to actually get the spacing of the holes just right and pleasing to your eye is actually quite another task. And I think the students who had to reconstruct this hairdryer, they really learn how to create one of these beautiful hole patterns that you see everywhere today, from portable speakers to hairdryers to all sort of devices. Right next to our museum, we have a local school, and we invited the young adults to come and pick objects from our collections. They mostly picked objects that they saw in the surroundings of their school. So we have a trash bin that is standing outside of their school. We have a kiosk sign that is close to their school. Also, there's a little golden chocolate bunny that we see here, probably something they like to eat. I think this contribution very much sums up what we are trying to do with this whole exhibition. We try to allow for other voices with other perspectives to look at our collection and pick and say something about the collection that only they would say. And when we had the opening, one of the kids came to me and told me, you know, Damien, this exhibition, it's really shit. It's really not good, except our own contribution, which I really love. Oh, it's the best. And I think this clearly shows that when you want to make an exhibition that resonates with different people, you really have to give them a place where they hear themselves, where they can see themselves in. And I think with school kids, absolute honesty, they don't lie. They will clearly tell you what they like and what they don't like. So that's, I'm incredibly happy about this remark of this young guy. It helped me so much to understand what actually resonates in an exhibition, what makes it relevant to someone or not. They developed this contribution over the course of multiple years. It was always our hope and idea that they would also have a sort of a conversation with design, with the shaped and design environment they find themselves in. Next year, for our 150-year anniversary, we will completely redo our permanent collection display. We'll have a new space for it, and we will try to really build on the experience that we've done here and really include them as well in this permanent collection display. And also we add a third, which we will call the atelier, where it's really also about to invite visitors to really also do something themselves, sit down, contribute small work, be it a drawing, or they can do something small with their hands, interact in some sort of ways with our collections directly. And I think these three pillars will form the new collection display.
This is a very big question, but what do you think the role of a design museum is today? I suppose we've got museums that are opening up, sort of people thinking about what they're here for. But for you right now in this moment, what do you think their role is?
Well, let's start it this way. Our collection has mostly the role of A, preserving objects, and also to exhibit objects. And these two roles are very difficult to combine because exhibiting always means not literally destroying, but it's never beneficial to the whole preservation aspect. If you want to preserve something, ideally you just lock it away forever in a sealed environment with no humans ever shedding their hair or skin in proximity of these objects. But obviously, we also want to open up and we want to show these works, because what use are they if they're just locked away? And so there's always this contradiction when it comes to the collections. But at the same time, we have a lot of exhibitions here that don't revolve around our collections. We are rather free in what we put on. We very often have exhibitions that don't have anything to do with our collections. So we have multiple roles. The role of these exhibitions is more to inform, surely, but also to entertain. I think these are the two things that we need to be doing, and especially today, where we want to reach society as a whole, and not only a small subgroup is a big driver of how we start to change how we conceive our exhibitions. And I think this is a rather large change that's going on with museums all over the place, where people really have the choice. Is what do I want to do on my weekend? Do I want to binge a new Netflix series, or do I want to go to the museum? And I think this is a very interesting conversation to have. Where do we actually position ourselves here? Are we an educational institution? Is it our role to like teach people? Is it our role to entertain people, let them have a good time in the museum? The answer probably lies somewhere between in the middle. We try to do both, and sometimes we are more successful, sometimes less so. But I hope we're on a good path.
The curator, Damien Fopp, there. I mean, Maylee, you were at the exhibition. We heard a little bit about it there. What are some of your takeaways? If you're going to be in that hot seat to re-examine the Gestaltung's archive and collection, what's the first step you're taking?
But one thing I found really exciting was the inclusion of young people in this particular exhibition. Objects they picked had a direct connection to their lives. It wasn't a case of items being picked for their provenance and stories they'd heard. These were items that these kids were encountering, and they included a metro sign, a bin, which is fine, and it's just as valid as maybe a beautiful one-off limited edition piece by a designer from the 60s. I think having that range in close proximity was really key. There was like a little lint bunny tucked away in one of the corners, and you go, well, yeah, this is how a young person understands the world. This bin's interesting because it looks a bit like a shark. That's something they've picked up. They haven't been told this. They're making these connections themselves, and I think there's something really fun about that, and not expecting people to have to arrive with this encyclopedia of knowledge.
That's kind of a perfect point to maybe end the show on. We sort of talked about it at the start, and the fact that, you know, a design museum can really focus on any topic or any subject and look at it through this design lens, and maybe that's the reminder. It's that the world around us ultimately has all been designed. So let's include some of that perspective in our design museums. I mean, Maylee, I asked Sophie at the start to design her ultimate design museum. What are some of the key features you're going to have in yours?
For it not to feel like this empty, cavernous, echoing chamber. I think there's something nice about having that shift in space, where you have these tiny, intimate ones that open out to wider vistas. So a range in spatial size and lighting as well. I've really noticed recently in exhibitions where they make a real attempt to not have this single light level across the whole space. When you spotlight certain items or allow others to be a bit lower, I feel like I'm more about the more atmospheric sensory parts of an exhibition space.
I mean, I love that. So we're going to combine that with some of Sophie's more local programming, and I think we've got a space that people ultimately want to be. But until that museum is built, you're just going to have to live with it on today's show, which is now coming to an end. So for more design stories, listen to our 5-minute midweek bonus show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs on Thursdays. And if you enjoy print, then do pick up a copy of Monocle magazine as well. It's on all good newsstands now. Today's episode was produced and edited by Maylee Evans. I'm Nick Manise, and you can reach me on nm@monocle.com. Thanks for listening.